Naomi, I'm Patrick McSweeney. I think I'm formerly a member of LSL, now a member of possibly the Web and Internet Sciences group, but it's all a little bit uncertain. Anyway, I wanted to put that on there because I want to be the first to give a presentation with the new research group name on it, if that is what the new research group name is.
AWS.
Yeah, Web and Internet Sciences. Let's not worry about security. The important thing is that today I'm going to be talking about open source licensing of software and why I think it's important in academia and the benefits that it gives you for doing it. So I'm going to start off, I'm going to talk a little bit about what open source licenses are. I'm going to talk about what different types are. Then I'm going to talk about a couple that you might use, just for examples. Then I'm going to talk about the good stuff, like the benefits to you and like what the advantages are to using them. Now, I am kind of here to sell you this. I was going to try and give it a neutral approach and decided that I couldn't. I'm not going to give you a comparison to proprietary licenses and stuff like that. You can do that in your own time. So I am sort of selling it to you, but I'm not selling it to you on the altruism. I'm selling it to you on the pragmatic benefits of, as a person who has released a number of pieces of open source software and felt the benefits of that. So when I'm talking, a lot of the time I'm talking from the literature, sometimes I'm talking from experience, sometimes I'm probably hyperbolizing a little, so feel free to call me on my stuff. So, what is open source software? Right, so, it's when you make a piece of software and you license it in such a way that when you give away the software, you have to give away the source code with it. Well, let's say give away, when you sell the software, you have to give the source code away with it. That's it, strictly. And then there are different types. There's also kind of intertwined with this, and a lot of people get the two terms, interuse the two terms when they maybe shouldn't, is free software, which is free as in the sort of ideological free, as in freedom, rather than the free as in beer. So, how does this work? When you create a piece of software, or anything for that matter, images, writing, you are the copyright holder of that material as it's created. You hold the copyright. As the copyright holder, you have the ability to license that to other people for them to use, right? So you can basically write a license which dictates how this piece of software can be used, or how this, you know, piece of writing can be used, or how this image can be used. And the users that you give the license to must, to be within the law, must comply to that, the terms of that license. And as I say, don't just do this for software, you do it for images. If anyone's familiar with Creative Commons, that's broadly speaking for other kinds of media. So, what types of licenses are there? There are, for software this is, there are copyleft licenses, permissive licenses, and shared source licenses. And these are kind of listed in order of most important, well, sorry, order of most evangelical, possibly. we'll try that. I haven't really worked out what the order is here, but there's definitely an order. So the copyleft licenses tend to be the most aggressively open, if you will. So a copyleft license forces not only modifications to that code to be made, so it doesn't only make the code open, it also makes any modifications to that code, and any code which builds on that code also has to be open. So it's kind of a play on copyright, copyleft. And it, a lot of people find these quite aggressive, and so there's a set of licenses which are the permissive licenses, which are designed to be a little bit more free-flowing. So this code is open, and it's you can do what you like with it. It's yours now. You use it how you want, redistribute it how you want, with some sort of exceptions, right? So a lot of them, things like this will be, oh, I want my name. You can use my stuff, just make sure you put my name on your stuff. and then the shared source licenses, this is kind of, and I don't know who actually came up with this idea. I've got a suspicion that it's Microsoft. They're definitely one of the key proponents of it at the moment. And this is kind of, it's a halfway house, right? So at the moment, when you buy a piece of software from Microsoft, like Office, for example, or Windows, right, you get a binary object, and you have absolutely no idea what happens inside that binary object. All you see is what's outside, right? You see the interface, and you never get to find out what the crazy bells and whistles inside are doing. Now, that seems fairly reasonable. I don't think it's that unreasonable, to be honest. But it's a little bit, if you're thinking from a business perspective, it's a little bit like going to someone and saying, I want to buy your car, and they say, that's fine, it's going to cost this much. And you say, okay, well, I might be willing to pay that. Can I just give it a little test drive or pop the hood and see what's inside? And the answer is no. Am I going to buy that? I'm not sure. What are you hiding under there? And so the shared source licenses are licenses where it's an open license, so you get the code with what you've bought, but there are strict terms usually which are you're not allowed to modify it and you're not allowed to redistribute it or anything like that. But what this gives you in a business world is some of the flexibilities of saying, hey, it's not just a black box. We trust you enough to see what's inside here, but you can't do anything with it. All you have is the knowledge that this isn't doing something evil. You can't do anything about it if it's not working properly. So, some examples. The GPL. The GNU project invented the GPL license in 1989, I think. This is Richard Stallman. Was a man who got very angry at some printer drivers and then took that out on the rest of humanity for the following 25 years about. And we're still feeling the repercussions now. The GNU public license is one of the most common and one of the most aggressive open software licenses. So it's a copyleft license. Now, it's one of the most aggressive copyleft licenses. So the code is open. Modifications to the code must also be open. Derivatives of the code must also be open. And code which links to the code must be open. So if a library is written in the GPL, and you want to link to that library, your code must also be GPL, because otherwise you're not playing by the rules, and that's illegal. So it forces the outcome of this, it forces other people to share their changes. So the basic goal was Stallman wanted to be in a situation where he could guarantee that he would never be cut out of the development of code that he'd written. Right? So by forcing everyone to share the derivative works, he gets to live off the fat of other people's labour, just in the same way that they got to live off the fat of his labour. The other important thing is you cannot, without the copyright holder's permission, you cannot re-license GPL code. So it's important to note, right, that while something has a software license on it, that's not like the end of the story. If I license something as GPL, I can license it as GPL generally, but then if you come to me and say, oh, Pat, I really need this as like a BSD license for this X, Y, and Z reason, and I think those are good reasons, I can license it to you specifically as BSD, or I can just say, hey, you know what, maybe I've done this wrong, maybe I should re-license my software as BSD.
Or I can say get lost.
Yes, because for whatever reason I don't agree with your principles. So don't feel that if you've chosen a license, that's the end of it, you've ruined it for yourself. You can always back out. There are some subtleties to that, which we might talk about in the discussion in a minute.
Can you change slides?
Yes. Good. Right, so the MIT license. This is one of the permissive licenses. This is used really commonly in academia. Maths particularly loves stuff like this. I mean, maths likes public domain, but some of the maths libraries are MIT as well, just because it kind of gives you some good stuff that we're all familiar with. So, the code is open. Anyone can use it. Feel free. Treat yourself. Put in whatever you like. Sell it. Package it up a different way. Sell that. Modify it. Sell the modifications. Whatever you like. The rules are the original copyright notice must be retained in all source code. Right? So, anyone who ever finds a derivative of your work, that derivative will have your name on it as this original source of this work. And that's a really nice property, right? That's, I will always be attributed for anything related to things that have been done with my code. But other than that, it's pretty much as open as you like. So other than that, the rules are that you must obviously retain that copyright notice. And the only other rule, basically, is an explicit disclaimer. And I think actually the GPL has an explicit disclaimer on it as well. I should probably know that. But the disclaimer is that if you use this software, it's not my fault if it goes wrong, basically. That I am not responsible for accidents and problems which occur as a result of my software under any allowable law. You're basically saying, I gave it to you for free, don't shout at me if you break something with it. So that's like a nice way to keep yourself out of trouble as well. And then, so this is one of the shared source licenses, the Microsoft ESLP. I really don't like shared source licenses because I don't think they're... Well, they don't offer you the opportunity to get some of the good advantages of open source, which I'm going to be talking about in just a minute. But they are very handy for that what's in the car problem. So the things to note about the ESLP is it's very, 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 very long. and it's very, very, very restrictive, right? So if for some reason part of a company developing new drivers for something or something like that needs part of the Windows source code, then this is usually the license they'll be given it under. And then Microsoft will give them a chunk of the source code and it says things like, except for internal use, when given explicit permission, you may never alter or redistribute or relicense or X, Y, Z on a Tuesday wearing a green shirt on the second Wednesday after the full moon, that sort of thing. Right? It's incredibly restrictive, but it does still give you that really juicy, I can make sure this does what I think it does. And Microsoft are known, actually, have a bit of a reputation for pulling a fast one on you because you don't know what's in their source code. Recently, for example, that scandal with the old stealing Bing search bar, stealing Google's Google search results or something. That's a bit of a hoo-ha that we'd have got around pretty quickly if we'd been able to look at the code to find out what it was doing. But instead, we had to look at the stuff and see the output. Right. So, people to keep an eye out for in open source. So, the Free Software Foundation, these are the guys who started it all, basically. Richard Stallman and his little band of zealots. They're really about the sort of altruistic principles of, oh, we should all give everything away, and everything should be free, and people should be unconstrained in how they choose to operate their software. And this is like some good hippie stuff. But there was quite a few people in the sort of mid to late 90s who thought, this is fine, it's nice like for programmers who tend to just, whatever they do, can we just make better software, please? This is a nice principle to sell to programmers. But the Open Source Initiative was formed, and this is a bunch of guys who said, we do agree with all those principles, but what we need is practical solutions which basically reward you for using these licenses. And so these guys are predominantly concerned with like business models related to open source, practical advantages. They do a little bit of developing new licenses, a little bit of funding projects and stuff. The Apache Foundation, who obviously are responsible for Apache, the web server, they, as far as I can tell, their agenda seems to be make as much cool stuff as possible. so they just get pots of money from places and then redistribute it to programmers who have got good ideas on the condition that the code is released under the Apache license, which is an open source license, quite similar to the MIT license. And then there's Microsoft, who are the guys who are kind of like... Microsoft have their own set of open source licenses, right? And they're, broadly speaking, quite similar to the general, like the open source licenses which most other people use. Usually with the exception of, this can never be combined with anything of any other kind of open source license. So it's like mega restrictive so that you can only combine with it. But these guys do still release code open source, other big players. Sun Microsystems, recently acquired by Oracle, are responsible for OpenOffice. Solaris is their open source operating system. So there are quite a lot of people who do a lot of stuff with open source. Right, so now for the interesting stuff, which is the benefits to you. So, it is my opinion, from having looked at this for quite a while, that open sourcing your code is really complementary to what we're doing already in academia. Usually the practices associated with an open source project are you will have a community which does lots of collaborative work together, and you will get lots of good feedback about your stuff. People will review it critically. So it's kind of similar to the peer review process. You basically submit something for review, people will look at it, and they'll decide, you know, is this good enough, suggest some corrections, that kind of thing. And as a result, you get a tougher paper out at the end of the peer review process. You get a tougher piece of source code out of your open source process. And the other thing is, obviously, working collaboratively and cross-discipline is something we're really big on in academia. And open source really enables this. Like, so a good example is the Linux kernel, which is released under the GPL. So this runs on, I think, something like 20% of all commercial servers now. And it is released under the GPL, and it has had about somewhere in the region of 2,000 contributors to the source code, which is obviously a massive undertaking and far larger than, say, well, it's probably about on the scale of the number of contributors there have been to the Windows source code, probably ever. And all of that work, well, not all of that work, a large majority of that work was done for free by people in their spare time. So, the benefits to you is lots of good publicity. If you're giving away the source code to your software on the internet, that's like brownie points for you. You get a lot of people who get very excited by the fact that they can modify your code and make really good use of it, right? So you've done something and someone looks at that and says, oh, this is a little bit like the work I'm doing in Institution X, but I need to tweak this a bit. And if they've got the source code, that tweaking process is really easy. If they haven't, it's really hard. And the other thing is, you write better code. Regardless of if no one ever looks at your source code, if you know that you are releasing something to... So, we've all done it, right? We all wrote a note to ourselves, just like, quick nipping out for lunch, write a note to remind me to do something when I get back. And you know what? You haven't checked the spelling. You haven't made it your best handwriting, because it's fit for purpose, right? Oh, I'm the only person who's ever going to look at this, so it doesn't need to be great. But if you're writing a blog post, say, or maybe even a tweet, you would make sure that, you know, your spelling was right and that you'd written down the vital information and the grammar was good, just because you know there's a potential other people are going to look at it, and that reflects on you. So you will write in the same way, if you know you're going to open source your code so that other people potentially can look at it, you will write better code regardless of whether people do look at it. And this is definitely true from my experience. So, benefits to your project. You're sharing your problems. So I've always been a bit of a fan of this, just like even from the textbook, but in practice, it's amazing how good this is. When we released MePrints, which was one of our first big GPL rollouts, community of people started forming around it, people who were interested in installing it in their institution, and these people do things like ask questions about, oh, well, sure, it works on Ubuntu, but does it work on Red Hat, or does it work on Windows, or whatever? And you start thinking about aspects of your code that you never even thought about before, and you think, oh, hang on, yeah, that's a good point. This probably breaks if you put it on Red Hat.
Most things do.
And so you also get suggested improvements or new feature requests and stuff. Oh, it'd be really good if it did this. And you're like, crikey, I haven't thought of that at all. Or someone will do something and say, hey, you know what? I'd like to use this for that. And you're like, oh my god, I'd never even imagined that was a possible use. You get bug tracking for free. Anyone who's using your code, if they find a problem, you're going to be the first person they tell. which is really handy, actually, because I do a lot of, and maybe it's the wrong thing to do, but I do a lot of throw the code out there and wait for the complaints to come back, because it's a lot quicker than spending 3 weeks testing the bloody thing. And you can make it an alpha release of your code or whatever, and encourage people to try it out and say that it's helpful for you. And this gets your bug tracking sorted. Also, sometimes people, because they've got the source code available, they'll find a bug, and then if they're a programmer, they'll go through your code and go, oh, well, this is where the bug is happening. And I've had quite a few instances of people emailing me about MePrints or about Preview Plus or about various other packages I've written, saying, oh, hey, I found this bug in your code. I fixed it using this, right? And I look at it and I go, huh, well, that's just the solution. Copy, paste, code is fixed. Good, and now that gets redistributed to everyone else, and that person doesn't have to maintain a little fork of the software for themselves, which is handy. So you also get code written for free. So MePrints is a classic example of this. Because it's a widget framework, there's a bunch of people who just like, oh yeah, well, I've got this specific widget that I need. I've written it. And then so sometimes you see someone's widget and you go, oh, can I have that? And they say, yeah, here you go, sure. I mean, they're legally obliged to, but that's fine too. and you get your own evangelists. So I am an evangelist, as you've discovered, just for the concept of open source. But you will get your own evangelists. So people who have used your software and think it's good, and they'll say to their friends, when their friends are doing something similar, they go, oh, have you looked at this? It's quite good. So that's more marketing for free and a wider user base and more code. More use of your code, rather. And then, so this is beneficial to the academic process because code which has been used a lot is more easily built on. So, if you've got code from your current project, which is being used a lot now, you're ironing out a lot of the bugs, you're getting rid of a lot of those horrendous gremlins that we've all written in code before, which means that you get away from the fear of, God, if I go and open that folder in Eclipse, what is going to happen to my hard disk? Right? Which means that in 2 years' time, when you think, oh, actually, the piece of work I'm doing now would be nicely complemented by that piece of work I did 2 years ago, rather than just thinking that, you can get out that piece of work you did 2 years ago and put it next to your current piece of work, and hopefully they look good next to each other, and that's great. But you can actually test it, because you've got source code you're not afraid of, which is quite important. And the other thing, and probably the most important thing, is I reckon, and I probably need to find some statistics to support this, but I reckon research papers which have tangible outputs as accompaniments. So if you've written a piece of, if you've reviewed a piece of software and you're also, as well as getting the paper, you also get the piece of software to look at, then you play with that piece of software, understand the concepts better, and that increases the chance of your papers getting citations, right? And that's really what we're all about here, right? We came to raise our impact factor, and if giving away some source code we've already written is a good way to do that, then let's make it easy to do. So, what I basically am trying to break the model a bit of having this being an hour lecture by now throwing it over to you guys for half an hour to just kind of ask any questions you have, get some discussion points together, talk about, you know, things that maybe, things that your experience if you've open sourced anything before, maybe like how stuff like that influences decisions you made on the project. Stuff that you think you've got that might be suitable for open source, you're just not really sure what to do with it, that kind of thing. So, if anyone's got any burning questions, please go right ahead.
So, So what if, this is both for corporate and academia,
right.
What if the content of your source code is the only thing which is of value? As in, the only thing which makes you better than your competitors or other people in the field is that the contents of that source code. Anyone else seeing that source code results in no leverage for you at all.
So, in the business world, that might be a concern. I'll come back to the business world in just a sec. In the academic world, I really think that you shouldn't think like this, right? The goal here is to move science forward. It's not about who's got the biggest willy, it's not about who's got the fastest source code, it's about us all getting a better understanding of what the hell is going on. And if you've got source code that enables people to do that, for God's sake, give it to them. Right? But, yeah, no, seriously though, there is business models associated with this, and that is a problem, right? So,
can I come and break in there?
Yeah, go.
This was the perennial fear when people started using open source at all, when the very first open source piece of software was made available, when Linux came out, as an open source and free. So this is free and open source, as well as just open source. You know, where is your commercial advantage? And actually, most big corporations find that giving software away allows them to sell many more services, and you get more money for services than you ever do for selling software. So you get more business models from, as I said, selling services, selling consultancy. This is how Red Hat make money, they're selling software. So you might say for distribution, they're selling a set of services that go with it.
So that's software. So this boils down to there being no inherent value of algorithms.
So what this is saying.
Do you pay for your Google?
No, that's true, I agree.
But equally, I think that Google might fall apart if you weren't if the PageRank was open source. Then I think Google's business model would fail. The point is that sometimes it's not complementary to your business model to open source your code, but often you think it's not and it is. So a good example of this was Star Office. Star Office was getting panned across the board, right? This is Sun Microsystems Office Suite. Getting panned across the board by Microsoft Office. Absolutely no, they weren't selling any copies, right? And so they got to the point where they were, well, we haven't got anything to lose by open sourcing it, I guess. So they just open sourced it, Now, that is OpenOffice, and I'd be surprised if there are many people in this room who haven't at least heard of it if they haven't used it. And what that made for Sun is massive props. And obviously, Sun got a load of development work on OpenOffice for free from the community, and it wasn't making them any money before. But what they do is they sell consultancy, right? They will come into your large organization and do bespoke deployments of OpenOffice and do clever stuff with networking documents and stuff, and they have their own, basically, suite of plugins which you can put onto OpenOffice, which add value to using OpenOffice. And you don't even pay for those plugins, you pay for someone to come to your place of business and set those up and get everything configured nicely together.
The services model is more to do with free software rather than open source software, though, isn't it? That's the you can still have that business model and have your source closed. It's just a case of giving the software away for free.
Yes, absolutely, you can. So Adobe is a good example. Adobe Reader, pretty much everyone's got it installed on their machine. It is free. And how Adobe make money on it is they sell Adobe Acrobat to people who want to produce PDFs. They give the reader away for free as a way to incentivize creating PDFs, as a way to sell software further up the chain. And the software they sell, I don't know if anyone's looked at how much a copy of Adobe Acrobat costs, but it's about, I think, £1,200 for a single commercial license for it. So, you know, if you want to say, have one on every machine in this institution, then that's going to cost you a couple of quid.
Part of the open source model as well is the fact of, you know, with Linux, you couldn't possibly have built Linux and got it to the state it was without a huge number of developers, as you said.
This is one of the key benefits to academia, I think, which is the getting code and bug tracking and stuff like that done for you for free. Because you don't, how Microsoft sells you Windows Server, or in fact Windows Desktop, is they go into your institution with a big marketing team and a load of expensive paraphernalia and a lot of free pens and stuff and mugs and all that stuff, and they go, hey, have a Microsoft hat, and you say, hey, this sounds pretty good, yeah, sure, I'll spend a couple of £1,000,000 of my institution's money a year on this, as long as I keep getting that hat. The Black Vault Developers Conference is another excellent example of this. But the point is that when you're a small academic research group, you don't have an enormous marketing team, you don't have people to go out and sell your stuff. Your stuff needs to kind of propagate itself. And you can actually use your... So, common model for open source software is we have a free version which is open source, and then we have a proprietary version which we sell you, or you give a model which is like free for academic use, and then you sell the... You get academics hooked on it, and then sell it to corporate people and stuff like that. So, yeah, all of these are ways of basically generating interest in your work. Yo.
We've got a Just Realize project, which sounds typically just gives with its realizing potential type name. But what we want to do is to look at the longevity, whatever it is, of open source software and how we could mentor or help someone who is actually producing software. Because what we found was that, in particular in the world of assistive technology, people put up their little open source project onto SourceForge or GitHub, and invariably after about 2 years it appeared to die. In other words, there was no community around it, there wasn't a governance model, they hadn't chosen a license perhaps correctly, because very few people understood the complexities of open source sourcing their software. The project ends in June, and we want to get more people onto the community. But I'd like to ask you, how do you feel you can prevent someone's really good idea dying after, say, 2 years, simply because they've left university, they've become a mega rich person in Microsoft or whatever, and they're no longer perhaps interested in their own project or their own idea and haven't got the energy to take it forward?
So yeah, this is kind of a good case in point, actually. So yes, sustainability, this is one of the biggest arguments against open source, usually. Open source, corporates that are selling you software will tell you open source isn't sustainable. And broadly speaking, they're kind of right, for this exact reason. If it's managed by one person in a shed, then if that person gets hit by a bus or decides that they don't want to work on it anymore, then that's kind of the end of development. But in a way, that's exactly where open source software has its own benefit, because the code is out there, so anyone can come in now and pick up that source code and go on to extend it. But for the immediate problem, that means that someone has to take up that mantle, and that mantle might be the poor company that's become dependent on this piece of open source software. What you can do to subvert this problem is it's all about building a strong community, right? So there are loads of ways to reward people who contribute to you, reward people who give you bug feedback. If anyone contributes code, you have a nice long credits file which says with special thanks to and name all the people. And you really lord that around to make sure that it's like a high prize to have helped you out here. And you know, you can do other things like if you've got some, you know, if you're a project at conferences and stuff, have your own workshops, get people together to talk about your software and build a bit of community. EA's mentioned a governance model. There's lots of complicated stuff online you can go and read about these things. But example in point is ePrints, which is probably one of the largest revenue streams for this department, which was written by Chris Gutteridge about 10 years ago now, actually. And it's GPL, it's open source. And Chris, kind of, to be honest, has moved on from ePrints. Like, probably about 4 years ago, Chris stopped doing substantial work on ePrints and started just checking other people's changes to make sure that they were okay. And that has enabled people like me and Tim Brody and Dave Tarrant to essentially take over the development of ePrints, because it's currently in our interest to do so, because we're running projects which depend on it and stuff. And Chris just sits there as a kind of figurehead, nodding as you go past. Even if you're interested in governance models, this is the benevolent dictator for life governance model, which is basically Chris always has the final say, but don't expect him to do any work. but yeah, so what you've got to do is basically ensure that you've got a well-organized project, so that you've got people that you are passing the mantle of developer onto. There's quite a few really nice examples of this happening in the past. Eric Raymond, who's a really strong advocate, he's one of the leaders of the open source initiative. He found a piece of software called I can't remember what it was called originally. I want to say Mutt, but it's not Mutt. Anyway, it was named after some kind of dog-related thing. that I do remember. And he found it, and it was a really good mail server at the time, where mail servers were really hard to find. And it was open source, and the guy had stopped working on it. And he just came in there and he said, hey, do you know what? This is really useful to me. Do you mind if I kind of take it over from you? And that became Sendmail, which for a long time was one of the most prevalent mail servers in, not just in corporate systems, but in all systems everywhere. A lot of mail servers were Sendmail. It's kind of been superseded by other things now. But the point is that that's an inherited project where basically the mantle was passed down. But it is nice, because it's nice to be able to say, oh, well, I still care about this thing, but actually I don't really want to put my time into it anymore. I want to be able to pass it on. And so if you've got your open source community started early, then by the time you're bored of it, you'll be ready to hand it over to the next person who's not bored of it yet. Cool.
I'll ask a question about changing my mind. What's the general ballpark on these licenses for relicensing? So, I mean, I know you said, obviously, GPL was that's a no-no. You can't say something's GPL and then change your mind.
You can say something's GPL and change your mind, but someone can't take your GPL code and change your mind.
Right, okay, so let me give you an example. Say I do a little bit of prototyping, and so I write a little bit of code, I think at the time, yeah, that's kind of cute, I decide to put that onto the web as open source, and maybe a few people go off and use that, or do whatever they want with it. And then maybe a couple of years later down the line, I'm working for a company, maybe I've been employed by someone, and I think, oh, you know, this thing we're doing right now, that tool I wrote 5 years ago would be really, really useful at the moment. Am I screwed because I can't use that? Because I made a GPL, can I not change my mind? I'd
right.
to use it. In my
so you've got about four courses of action. Yeah. So the first one is So you can't undo what you've done, right?
Yeah.
Now that's GPL.
I wouldn't care necessarily about stopping other people using that protocol.
Ah, well, this is
the time I then use my GPL code.
You fall into option three of the four. But let's go down the list. So the first thing you can do is take it offline, destroy all evidence, hope that nobody's found it. If they have, well, That's fine. Then don't tell anyone that it's that piece of code you've put into your wonder software, right? And no one will know that that's the awesome sauce in your pie. So that's quite a neat, like, black bag in disguise mechanism. Or you can do the other one, which is you can. So this is maybe option two or three. You can leave it open source, but then relicense it to yourself or to your company or whoever it's important to have. You can relicense that source code to them in whatever license they want. And the other thing is, you can just say, okay, well, I'll leave that as, so this was option two, which I should have said, is you can leave that source there as open source, but then make a branch of it and say, right, my branch, so any future work I do on this will be closed source, but this open source base remains on the internet. And option four is, just make the piece of software that you're working for the company open source.
Okay. That may or may not be.
Yeah. So that's not always. That's not often appropriate.
Okay.
That's
sure.
Always.
So that's
one of the issues that happens with that, though, is if somebody else has made some modifications to your code, your original code, and those modifications are due for as well. And if it's, let's say, it's an additional component, it's an additional feature, which is GPL'd, then you've got to be very careful about how. Which bit you choose to
withdraw. That's very important to note. You can only relicense the code that you wrote.
Exactly. Of course, naturally.
So, typically, IBM gets itself about a million lawsuits every year when they're checking patent infringements. And one of the big problems that IBM have found is that they've so cut down what people can do because of the fear of GPL that most IBM software just doesn't really get worked on that, actually. Because they're scared of open source, it's made a culture for certain people that they won't use a particular license. They think it's vile, and they're worried about patents.
This is so
anti-open source. It's damages them, I think, actually.
When you run a project like this, if you're going to take a lot of work from other contributors, and you're worried that in future you might want to use their code and close source their code, then you have to. And this is kind of like.
It's a bit paradoxical, though, isn't it?
It's a bit
people have never got their contributions if you didn't make it open source in the first place.
Yes, but you can get them to sign a waiver which says, you know, I give this to you, to your project, in the understanding that it gets used for whatever your project is.
Or you can just use a non-aggressive license like MIT.
Yes, or you can use a non-aggressive license like MIT, and then when they release their stuff as MIT, you can steal it also.
Can I just expand on my original question just quickly, Dale? I agree. Thanks for confirming on how changing my mind in that instance. In a different instance, say I was an evil super genius, I wouldn't necessarily do this myself, but say I decided to release something that's open source because it's incredibly popular and prevalent, and I was like, oh, there's something to this now. Can I then withdraw that and decide to sell it?
You can stop distributing it, but you can't undistribute the things. Like, the copies people have are theirs now.
And that they are still GPL'd, and it's not really.
And they can make their own branches on that.
So all you do is make your slightly better.
I want to go to.
Sure. Yeah, that's
Jonah.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention one other problem that we have now with open source licenses, which is the fact that we have so many web based applications now. And obviously, you have some websites which run with an open source code, but the code, I mean, it's quite difficult to say, well, this is a web application, we give it to you, but the code is still in our server and we don't distribute it. So you have like this ambiguity saying, well, we built this business and it runs on open source code, but we're still allowed to keep the source to ourselves.
Yes, so this is, I'm not distributing the argument which is the software is on my server, so I'm not distributing it. Yeah. So if I've used GPL code, because I'm not distributing it, I don't have to distribute source code. Yeah, it's a problem. It's fine. You know,
is that a loophole then? You don't have to distribute.
Arguably a loophole or just a feature.
That's been discussed. I mean, I think between the GPL 2 and the GPL 3, the GPL 3 doesn't allow that, doesn't allow you to just keep it on your server without giving the source away. But that means many projects stayed on the GPL 2 because they wanted to keep that.
You're not distributing a compiled version of it, but you're still distributing the output of it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like putting a laptop in front of someone and saying now that they can see the source code.
So the interesting thing is that the staying on GPL2 thing is really a non-argument. because one of the lines of the GPL2 is, or at a later version of this or a later version of this license at your discretion. So a person can have that and distribute it as GPL3, even though they got it as GPL2.
Yeah, so.
But that's kind of part of the grand Stallman plan, I think, which is if I take it, I can make a version of this GPL3, and now people have to distribute it when they use it in web apps as well. So, Marcus, you've been waiting a little while. Is it gone?
Got mentioned.
Okay, cool.
So, I have one more question. So, somebody else in their hand up here.
Thank you. So, how does it affect Java
pipes?
If you used only the Java file, you didn't use the code itself, how does that affect? I mean, you didn't use the code. Like if you're using an Apache server, but you didn't use the code, how does that affect the license itself? It doesn't affect it.
So what you're saying is, if I wrote a program which uses somebody else's jar file, and that jar file is open source or not?
Yes.
Right. So depending on the license, basically it does not become your responsibility to distribute that jar file. Unless you bundle it with. Well, even so, it's not your responsibility to do it. It's something you can choose to do. And also, how does it affect it in terms of it's about the license. If I link to a piece of MIT code, MIT license code, my code can be any license I want. But if I link to a piece of GPL code, a strict term of the GPL is that if you want to link to it, the code that links to it has to be GPL as well.
So even if it's distributed as an executable?
Even if it's distributed as an executable, if it's distributed under the GPL license, you still have to open source your code.
And if it's distributed as GPL, you have to provide the source code anyway. It's compulsory in the license. So
that's
a
GPL license?
Yes. So the lesser GPL license, or library GPL license, is designed for this purpose. If you're making a library that you want other people to use, but you don't want to force them to open source things that link to it, you use the lesser general public license, which means that the source code for the library is distributed by the person who created it, and people can link to it in the same way you can link to MIT, and you still choose your own license. But any modifications that person makes to the library, so the library source code, those changes must be distributed. Yeah?
So, seeing as we're talking about distribution, I was going to say, I know trying to control distribution once you release something on the internet is a bit of a sort of effort in vain anyway, but are there any sort of licenses that control distribution? So can I, for example, say, I want to open source this, okay, I want you to credit me when you use it, you can do whatever the hell you want with it, but I want to be the only person who distributes, you cannot redistribute my code.
So Wikipedia has a great comparison open source licenses, which I recommend you look at. There are a couple which say I can be the only source, the tree only branches ones.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
I can't think of one off the top of my head. There's like a variant on BSD or something, but ultimately all these licenses are just pieces of text, right?
And you can make
amendments to it. And you can, so GPL specifically supports this. You can have exceptions. So I give you this under the GPL license with this exception, which is that you're not allowed to distribute my code.
Sure.
Okay. Maybe there's some argument for doing that. Bear in mind that does kind of make the handing over the ownership of the project to someone else thing very difficult.
Yeah.
So you might need to think about that if you ever need to hand your project over. Right.
So I had a question. Going back to the benefits for you. Go back to that. It seemed to me as if that there wasn't really enough inherent motivation just within those two, especially as projects scale down. So it's great for Linux, you definitely get lots of publicity because millions of people use it.
Sure.
It's pretty good for eBrint because hundreds of people maybe use it, hundreds of people use your plugins. For a PhD student, maybe two people use it if you're lucky. And therefore, the publicity is not really a good thing.
Well, I guess
the writing a better code is a massive hindrance. It's going to be the thing that might stop you from.
I mean, I've had direct experience with this. So, papers that release their code
are so much better and so much better cited as well. Loads more people cite them. So because you can grab their code, you can read it, you can re-implement it, and you can cite them directly. And produce their results as well.
So,
but why is that so field dependent? That happens in your field, but I've never seen anyone release their code in my field.
Neither have I, but I'm a ranger.
Oh, and it's rubbish.
It's rubbish code. It's rubbish code, right? Because there's no.
It's better than rubbish nothing.
There's no releasing good code. Like, so they'll release this uncommented MATLAB nonsense, right? But at least they release something, and that those papers will get cited more. Then you compare it to like Lowe's implementation of SIFT, which was originally released open source, and just how much that spread, how many people are only using SIFT as their feature.
Is that a PhD project?
No, he was a prof at the time. But
so he already had lots of publicity, which was
well,
no,
actually, that scale. Was the first time he used
it. I think the interesting thing to note, Ricky, is that this is like I'm thinking from a research project angle.
Yeah.
So no, probably if you're a PhD student, you are both you are the project, and you are part of the wider academic community. So probably the benefits listed here apply to you directly. The one thing you do want to avoid, try and avoid getting bogged down in if you're doing a PhD, guys, is don't let the code run your PhD. You run the PhD, the code runs itself. Because if you're getting bug tickets from people and you say, don't be afraid to say, hi, oh, thanks for your feedback. I haven't got time to work on this right now, but I'll make a note of it on the internet so that other people know it's a bug, and then maybe there's a chance someone else will come along and go, oh, God, that bug irritates me as well, I'm going to fix it. And then someone will send you the fix and say, hey, I fixed it. So now you've got the bug tracking and the solution written for nothing. But yeah, you've got to be careful about how you run this project. Don't let your open source project run your PhD.
We were talking about management and how it's important to have a community and everything. One of the things that were lacking until quite recently is the good tools that need to actually make that thing run correctly, allow people to input fixes and things like that. I mean, until SourceForge and GitHub, it was very difficult to actually organize a project from a technological point of view. So what kind of things do you use in your work?
So for a lot of my work, I've piggybacked off the ePrint infrastructure, where because ePrint is big enough, we run our own bug tracker, we run our own SVN, we've got a special SVN for people who are doing projects related to ePrint, which is open to anyone who wants to go. And obviously you've got the publicity sites covered by their website. Like when I'm doing stuff personally for me, I tend to use Google Code because you get an SVN, you get a wiki, you get a bug tracker, and Google gives you it instantly. I've tried using SourceForge in the past. To get a SourceForge, you have to go through an approval process, and that approval process, last time I went through it, took 4 days. No offense, but I was in a hurry. So SourceForge hasn't really won me a lot of prizes, but I think for large projects, it's probably better.
Can I say, one of the problems with SourceForge we found, looking at for open source projects, in particular related to our department of sort of assistive technology, it has no categorization. It doesn't help you to find projects. Mm. It's incredibly difficult. The tags are almost non-existent. And the same with GitHub and Drumbeat, which is a Mozilla Foundation project, which also hosts open source projects, but not for the source code, but just to host them, is exactly the same. There seems to be no way of putting in categories or tags to actually help this publicity. We've been using Redmine, Russell, which is reminding me for our project, and I have to say that has absolutely everything there, and it's very easy for me as someone who doesn't code to be able to keep track of projects.
That's the thing, open source projects, they don't only need coders, they need translators.
That's right, and that's Redmine actually has all the wikis and forums and everything there, but it's not particularly good for publicity, because SourceForge and GitHub is better known and is used in a more open way.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that we're looking at on this Realize project, that we've realized this is a huge issue about how you get your code out there, how you build your community. I hardly dare mention OSS Watch from GIST. Do have quite a lot of information on the subject if you want to go there and have a look. And we are using their expertise in our project.
Yeah.
And one of the things they produce for us, which is not public, is their openness rating. And we'll be putting that on our project website. And the good news about that one is that it walks you through the process and shows you exactly how to make the best of what you're doing with your open source project. Yeah. And it scores it for you. And we'll be putting it up on the website in the coming week, and I'll let everybody know about it. Yeah.
I think what's really true is that open sourcing your stuff isn't just chucking it over the wall, which is what people thought it was. If you just made your stuff and made it available, everybody would come.
Yeah.
Well, they don't. Yeah. Well, first off, they have to find it. Then they have to find it useful in some way. Even if it's sometimes a very small thing that's widely applicable, can get a lot of followers because it's widely applicable. Very niche stuff sometimes doesn't. So then it's got going because everybody could use it. So operating system things, the Apache Foundation, all the things they've done, have found a general following because there are going to be millions of people who could use it or apply it or choose it. Something that's very focused, with a very small likely distribution, it can just disappear. But then you have to think, well, does that matter, actually? Not everything is going to flourish. And maybe it's right that not everything does. But if you really care about something, as I said, that's the day where you have to go out there and evangelise it. But you're much more likely to get a really, really terrific thing than to actually get along if it's really, really widely applicable and everybody's going to want a piece of it.
But on the other hand, if it is niche, you've then got to allow the people to find it. And that's coming down to the tagging, to the metadata, to all this publicity business that you might have to do yourself at the beginning. That's what we want to enable.
Yeah, there's almost a work of SEO to do in order to get people to actually find their relevant project.
Yeah, so you can't just chuck it over the wall.
Yeah.
Well, commercial projects have to do it.
Yeah.
So I don't see why open source ones shouldn't have to do it.
Well, the only thing I would say is that as PhD students, you're kind of primarily placed, right? Because you're writing code for academia, so, and you're writing it yourself, so usually there's no reason not to open source it. But also, you have got opportunities to do marketing, right? Your code is directly related to your PhD. You write papers in this vein. So every time you give a presentation about your work, you say, and also the code that I'm using to do my stuff is available on this website. And that you're talking directly to a community of interested parties, or some interested parties at least, who then have nowhere to go to find out more and have something they can play with, something tangible, which gives them some kind of feedback about what your work's really about.
Yes,
if it's okay with everybody, I'd quite like to wrap it up.
Sure.
I was going to just close actually with, I had some conversation prompters there, if times were hard. This long-term benefit stuff I think is really important. And the only other thing I'd say is check out some of the extra reading if you're interested. So I've got from like most evangelicals, least evangelical here, Free as in Freedom. This is Richard Stallman's biography. I thought it was a really good book, but I think I'm probably predisposed to think that, so don't be... It's open source anyway, so just go and download yourself a copy. Or you can buy the hard book for about 20... hardback, I think, for 20 quid. Just for fun, this is the Torvalds biography. This is much more about, like, the pragmatics of running an enormously large project with, like, 2,000 contributors and how you... like, what the side effects of having done that are, and how you just turn out to accidentally revolutionise the field of computer science and per chance make yourself $1 million in the process. Mm-hmm. It's all a hilarious accident. It's a lovely book to read. The Cathedral and the Bazaar, this is Eric Raymond. He's a man who used to write for Wired magazine. He writes a lot of cool stuff about business models associated with open source and all the other kind of literature around that. And then this is not related to open source at all, really, but is a very interesting book and also free on the internet. Or most of Eric Raymond's stuff is free on the internet. Just for fun, I think you do have to pay for. Free, the price, the future of a radical new price, is a book by Chris Anderson. It's available online for free. It's about the economics of giving things away and generating value from giving, how you generate value from giving things away, basically. But it's not really applied to software, it's applied to like economic practices. So this is like, if you want to just keep your head out of the source world and just find out how businesses use free give, how businesses give things away to make money, basically, then this is really interesting. And as well as the book being free online, also the audio transcripts of the book are online, so you don't even have to read the damn thing, you just have it piped into your ear whilst you're working. Right, I think that's about me done. EA, do you have anything you want to wrap up with?
Want to thank you very, very much for being such an incredibly
I'd like to thank you all for coming. I'm sorry if it was a bit dull. I'm glad that we managed to string out 35 minutes of discussion there, because I was a bit dubious that it might not happen. Thank you all. There's food at the back.
Okay. I upload a video to EdShare.
What happened? I just pressed.